Welcome to today's deep dive, everyone. We're really thrilled to have you with us because today, we are looking at something that honestly flips everything I thought I knew about science completely upside down.
Oh, absolutely. It's one of those topics that fundamentally rewrites how you actually see the world.
Yeah, exactly. So for you listening, I want you to think about how we usually picture the ultimate pursuit of truth. Like you usually imagine this incredibly sterile scene, right?
Right, like a gleaming white laboratory.
Yes, a lone scientist in a crisp white lab coat. They're like leaning over a microscope late at night. The heady steel doors are just sealed shut.
They are completely physically isolated from the messy, noisy world outside.
Exactly, completely shut off from the heavily opinionated world. And the core assumption we carry around is that inside that room, there's just pure data. Just, pure unadulterated objectivity.
It's a remarkably powerful cultural myth, honestly. We hold this deeply ingrained idea that to truly see the world as it actually is, you have to strip away everything human about yourself. Right, like you have to become a robot or something.
Exactly. You have to become a blank slate, an emotionless recording device. The prevailing logic is that human values, cultural backgrounds, personal preferences, all of those are contaminants.
Okay, so let's unpack this because today we are diving into an incredibly thought-provoking academic paper. It's titled The Grammar of Inquiry by C.F. Dietz. And this text systematically dismantles that entire pristine laboratory myth.
It really does. Dietz is bridging the philosophy of science, specifically the groundbreaking work of Stanford philosopher Helen Longino, with this fascinating overarching concept called the closure framework.
Yeah, and our mission for this deep dive is to explore why true objectivity isn't about being perfectly unbiased at all. It is actually about how a community organizes itself to argue, to criticize, and to, evolve.
Which raises the stakes considerably, I think, because this isn't just a niche academic debate about how scientists work in a lab.
It's a fundamental investigation into how any group of people, whether that's a research team, a corporate board, or just society at large, can actually claim to know something to be true.
Right.
The paper argues that trying to lock all human values out of the laboratory isn't just impossible, it is an epistemic dead end. If you try to strip away the human element, you don't get closer to the truth, you actually blind yourself to it.
That is like the ultimate paradox to me.
Yeah.
The paper asserts that science is completely driven by human values, interests, and biases. Yet, it remains our absolute best path to objective truth. How can those two realities even coexist?
Well, to figure that out, we really have to start where the text starts, which is the gap between evidence and theory. Dietz hits us with this foundational premise right out of the gate. He writes that no observation is self-interpreting.
No observation is self-interpreting. That's a huge statement.
It is. And what's fascinating here is how deeply that challenges the standard empiricist picture we are all taught in school. We tend to operate under the assumption that facts just speak for themselves.
Right, like the data just magically tells you what it means.
Exactly. The belief is that if you collect enough raw data, the data will naturally assemble itself and hand you a neatly printed label that says, here is the exact hypothesis I support.
But Dietz, channeling Longino's philosophy, points out a severe logical failure in that model, right?
He does. Raw data on its own is entirely mute. It means absolutely nothing without a web of background assumptions to give it a voice.
Okay, the paper provides a really grounded example to illustrate this gap, and I think it helps a lot.
Yeah.
Imagine you are testing a brand new blood pressure medication.
Right, a standard clinical trial.
Exactly. You run a trial, and at the end, you have a massive spreadsheet full of raw data. Just hundreds of systolic and diastolic readings taken before and after patients consumed the pill.
Just rows and rows of numbers.
Yeah. And on the surface, it seems incredibly straightforward. The numbers went down, therefore the drug works. But the text forces us to pause and realize that the numbers themselves do not contain the concept of working.
Right, because if we break down that leap from the numbers decreased to this medical intervention is effective, we find a massive bridge. And that bridge is constructed entirely of background assumptions.
Like what? What kind of assumptions?
Well, the data doesn't tell you that your blood pressure cuffs were calibrated correctly. You just have to assume that.
Oh, true.
The data also doesn't tell you what constitutes a clinically significant drop. I mean, is a 2-point decrease a medical breakthrough, or is it just statistical noise?
You have to decide that based on prior medical frameworks.
Exactly. You also have to assume you've properly controlled for confounding factors. Did the patients change their diet? Did their stress levels drop for completely unrelated reasons?
Right, you have to select a comparison group and just assume they are a valid baseline.
Yes. every single one of those decisions is brought to the data by the human beings who are designing the study.
I like to visualize raw data as this massive, chaotic pile of bricks dumped in an empty lot.
I love that analogy.
Yeah, because if you just stare at the bricks, they do not inherently tell you whether you are supposed to build a suspension bridge or a cathedral or, like, a retaining wall.
Right. They are just fired clay.
Exactly. It is the architect's blueprint that gives those bricks structure, purpose, and meaning. So in scientific inquiry, the background assumptions are the blueprint.
Building on that analogy, the critical realization that Longino brings to the table is that those blueprints are never neutral.
Never neutral, okay.
Right, the architect doesn't draft a blueprint in a vacuum. Every assumption used to connect the data to the theory reflects the interests, the values, and the prior commitments of the scientific community at that specific moment in time.
So you literally cannot bridge the gap between a pile of bricks and a finished building without making a series of highly contextual human choices.
Exactly.
But hold on, I have to jump in here for you listening, because this is where the traditional rigid view of the scientific method practically screams in protest.
Oh, for sure. It's very uncomfortable.
Right. Because a scientist's literal job is to leave their cultural baggage at the door.
Yeah.
That is the entire reason we invented double-blind studies and control groups and peer review. We are taught that a good scientist identifies their background assumptions and actively neutralizes them.
Right.
So are we really saying that centuries of rigorous scientific method are just an illusion? Like, researchers are just hopelessly trapped in their own biases?
That is the exact friction the text wants us to sit with. Longino argues that you literally cannot neutralize those assumptions because they are the very tools you use to think.
Wow.
The background assumptions are completely entangled with the social, cultural, and political context of the investigators. They are the water the fish is swimming in.
The water the fish is swimming in. That makes sense.
Yeah. And if you try to step outside your human context to interpret data from this mythical view from nowhere, you lose the ability to interpret the data at all. You can't read the spreadsheet without a framework. And every framework is built by a specific culture in a specific era.
Which brings the text to a really striking historical example that proves this isn't just, you know, abstract philosophy. The paper looks closely at the feminist critique of biology that gained momentum decades ago.
Yes, it's a brilliant case study.
And I want to be perfectly clear to our listener here. The text isn't bringing this up to take a modern political stance, and neither are we. It just uses this era as an impartial, documented case study to observe the actual mechanics of how science evolves.
Right. We are just looking at the historical record. And the historical record of biology, specifically in fields like evolutionary biology and primatology, it offers a perfect demonstration of background assumptions at work.
So what actually happened?
Well, feminist critics began analyzing established, widely accepted research on primate behavior. And what they found wasn't that the raw data was fabricated.
So they weren't just making up numbers.
No, not at all. But they found that the existing background assumptions used to interpret that data were heavily skewed by the dominant social values of the time.
The paper highlights how assumptions about traditional gender roles, assumptions about what constituted a natural baseline, and assumptions about the evolutionary significance of sex differences, they were actively shaping every stage of the scientific process.
Right down to the ground level.
Yeah. These unexamined values dictated what environments the experiments were conducted in, which specific behaviors were even cataloged, how the results were described in journals, and ultimately what narrative was constructed from the data.
To get specific, for a very long time, male-dominated research communities approached primatology with a set of contextual values that prioritized competition, hierarchy, and physical dominance.
So they were basically looking for things that matched their own social worldview.
Exactly. Consequently, their background assumptions framed male primate behavior as the primary driver of evolutionary adaptation. The researchers spent their time meticulously observing and recording male dominance hierarchies.
And what about the female primates?
They largely ignored female social structures, basically dismissing them as passive or secondary. Now, the raw data, the actual monkeys living in the jungle, was entirely indifferent to this.
Right. The monkeys are just being monkeys.
Yes. But the blueprint being used to build the scientific theory was inherently shaped by the researchers' own social context.
And when a more demographically diverse group of scientists entered the field, they didn't necessarily bring different monkeys into the lab. They brought a different set of background assumptions.
Yes, a new blueprint.
They looked at the exact same primate troops and noticed complex, cooperative social scaffolding. They saw female-driven mate selection and these intricate communication networks that the previous generation of researchers had literally not even bothered to write down.
That shift is the crux of the argument here. The new insights didn't materialize because the empirical data changed. They materialized because the values changed.
Right.
The feminist critics demonstrated with absolute precision that you cannot separate the scientific descriptions of reality from the social values of the people doing the describing.
So if I'm processing this correctly, it leads to a rather terrifying question.
Okay, let's hear it.
If everyone has bias, if no one can escape the water they're swimming in, and if those biases construct the very foundation of how an experiment is interpreted, aren't we just conceding that science is totally subjective?
It's a very common fear.
Right. Isn't this a direct slide into pure relativism? Like the whole your truth is your truth, my truth, and the data just says whatever we want it to say.
It looks like a slide into relativism, definitely. But Longino brilliantly pivots away from that trap.
Okay, how?
Well, relativism fundamentally asserts that because everyone operates from a biased perspective, all claims are equally valid and there is no ultimate truth. Longino firmly rejects that despairing conclusion.
So she still believes in objective truth?
Absolutely. She argues that science does give us genuine, objective knowledge about the world. Our mistake has simply been looking for objectivity in the wrong place.
What do you mean? Where have we been looking?
We've been searching for it inside the mind of the individual.
Oh, the lone scientist in the sterile room.
Precisely. If it is neurologically and philosophically impossible for an individual scientist to be free from social values, then objectivity cannot be a property of an individual person.
Okay, so where does it live?
Longino argues that objectivity is a property of a community. The path to objective knowledge runs exclusively through the social organization of inquiry.
The social organization?
Right. It is a collective structural achievement, not an individual moral triumph over bias. Objectivity is a team sport.
That is a massive paradigm shift. It completely removes the impossible burden on the individual to act as a flawless, unbiased calculating machine.
Right, which they can't do anyway.
Right. It places the responsibility entirely on how the group interacts, how it argues, and how it corrects itself. But, I mean, to really understand how a group manages to extract objective truth out of a bunch of subjective individuals, we have to look at the two different categories of values the paper discusses.
This is a crucial distinction in Longino's framework. She divides values into two distinct types. First, you have constitutive values.
Constitutive values. Got it.
Right. These are the deeply held principles that are widely shared across almost all scientific communities. They are the rules of the game that make science recognizable as science.
So what would be an example of that?
We're talking about values like empirical accuracy, predictive power, internal consistency, and broad explanatory scope.
Okay, so those are the baseline rules of the scientific method. They constitute the practice itself. But then you have the second category, which is contextual values.
Right. Contextual values are the specific, localized preferences held by particular investigators and their immediate communities.
So this is where the human element really comes in.
Yes. These encompass everything from a preference for qualitative over quantitative methods to the cultural and political beliefs of the era, to the economic pressures dictating what research gets funded. It even includes the personal assessment of what questions are even deemed worth asking in the first place.
And historically, the traditional view of science treats these contextual values as the enemies of truth. Right. Like the contaminants that must be scrubbed from the clean room.
Exactly. But the source material makes this incredibly radical, counterintuitive claim. Longino argues that contextual values, the very biases we are constantly trying to destroy, are actually constitutive of evidence.
Wait, they are constitutive of evidence? What does that mean?
It means they determine what even counts as a piece of evidence in the first place. They aren't a bug in the system. They are the operating system itself.
That is a pivotal, almost dizzying insight.
It really is. You cannot have evidence without a context to make it relevant. A drop in blood pressure is only evidence of a drug's efficacy if your contextual values prioritize that specific biological metric over, say, the patient's holistic sense of well-being or the environmental cost of manufacturing the drug.
I think about contextual values like a pair of tinted glasses that are permanently grafted to your face.
That's a great way to put it.
Yeah, because you literally cannot take them off. The lenses are your retinas. If you magically remove them, you wouldn't see the pure, untinted truth. You would just be completely blind.
Right, you wouldn't be able to process the data at all.
Exactly. So the goal of science, then, isn't to source everyone to try and rip their glasses off. The goal is to get a massive room full of people who are all wearing different colored tinted glasses and have them furiously compare notes on what they see.
Exactly. Because the danger with those tinted glasses isn't just that they color your view of the world. It's that you eventually forget you were even wearing them.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
If everyone in your laboratory is wearing the exact same blue tinted glasses, you will all look at a purple object, collectively agree that it is blue, and publish a peer-reviewed paper stating that it is objectively blue.
And no one in the room would think to question it.
Right. That is why Longino insists that you need a room full of people with different lenses. You need someone with red glasses to walk in, look at your data, and say, why is everyone ignoring the red hues here?
And when that collision happens, when the person with the red glasses challenges the consensus of the blue glasses, that is what Longino calls transformative criticism.
It is the absolute engine of scientific progress.
Yeah.
Transformative criticism isn't just surface-level nitpicking. It's not someone double-checking your math on page 4 or pointing out a typo in your methodology.
It's deeper than that.
Much deeper. Transformative criticism actually challenges the deeply held background assumptions themselves. It challenges the tint of the glasses.
It's like the difference between someone saying you calculated the trajectory of this falling object incorrectly versus someone saying your entire assumption that objects naturally fall downward ignores the curvature of space-time.
Exactly. That is a perfect example. And to generate that profound level of critique, a community absolutely requires what the text refers to as epistemic diversity.
Epistemic diversity.
Yes. You need a vast diversity of background assumptions and contextual values operating in the exact same space. Now, the paper carefully notes that while epistemic diversity very frequently tracks with demographic diversity, because people from different backgrounds naturally carry different contextual values, the core functional requirement is epistemic.
So it's about diverse ways of knowing and seeing.
Precisely. Mm-hmm. You need critics who approach the domain from entirely different angles. You need observers who can clearly see what the dominant approach is completely taking for granted.
Okay, so let's play this out practically. We have our diverse room full of people with different tinted glasses. But if we just lock them in a room and let them yell at each other, that doesn't automatically generate objective truth.
Right, definitely not.
I mean, social media is essentially a giant room full of people screaming at each other from fundamentally different perspectives. Mm-hmm. And I don't think anyone would describe that as a finely tuned engine of objective truth.
No, definitely not.
So there has to be a structural mechanism to process all that friction.
Which transitions us perfectly into the most rigorous practical section of Dietz's paper. Longino doesn't just leave us with the vague idea that diversity is good. She proposes four specific rigid norms that a community must satisfy if it is going to transform subjective friction into objective knowledge.
The mandatory rules of engagement for that room.
Exactly.
So if I'm trying to build a functional scientific society from scratch, I can't just rely on good vibes. I need infrastructure. If someone in this room has a transformative critique, they can't just mumble it to themselves in the corner.
Right. Longino defines that first requirement as having recognized avenues for criticism.
Recognized avenues.
Yes. There must be established structural forums where critical challenges are officially registered. In the scientific world, this looks like peer-reviewed academic journals, open conferences, and formalized debate panels.
So it cannot just be hallway gossip or informal complaints.
No. There has to be a public arena where a critique is given a microphone and cannot simply be ignored by the people in power.
Okay, so we have the microphone, we have the academic journal, but if someone gets up to the microphone and starts speaking a completely different language, mm-hmm. or citing like astrological charts to refute a physics paper, the conversation goes nowhere.
Which brings us to the second norm. Shared evaluative standards.
Shared standards.
For a critique to be meaningful and intelligible, the community must agree on common criteria for evaluating arguments. If I am criticizing your clinical trial, I have to be able to appeal to a standard we both respect, like empirical accuracy or statistical significance or predictive power.
Because if we don't share any foundational standards, we aren't debating. We're just talking past each other in parallel universes.
Exactly. The shared standards are the gravity that keeps the debate grounded.
But I have to pause here. Because looking at those first two norms, I see a massive potential collision.
Oh, really? Where?
Well, we need epistemic diversity to get different viewpoints, right?
Yeah.
But we also need shared standards to govern the debate. In the real world, shared standards are usually written by the people who have historically held the most power.
That is very true.
So couldn't a dominant group just weaponize their own contextual values, label them as the shared standards, and use them to quietly silence any minority voices?
They absolutely could.
They wouldn't even have to look biased. They could just say, well, we aren't excluding you because of your background. We're rejecting your paper because your methodology doesn't meet our shared standards of what rigorous science looks like.
This raises an incredibly vital question, and it is a vulnerability that Longino's framework anticipates and directly addresses. If the shared standards are treated as immutable, unquestionable laws handed down from on high, then yes, they inevitably become tools for exclusion.
They become a fortress.
Exactly, they become a fortress. That is exactly why Longino insists that the standards themselves must be constantly subject to critical discussion.
So you don't just argue about the data. The community has to constantly argue about the rules of the argument.
Continually. The standards have to be stable enough to allow for debate, but flexible enough to be rewritten when a transformative critique proves they are too narrow.
Wow.
If a dominant group simply refuses to allow the shared standards to be criticized, they are violating the third norm of objectivity.
Which is genuine responsiveness to criticism.
Yeah.
And honestly, this feels like the most difficult norm for any human institution to actually achieve.
It is the ultimate litmus test for a community's epistemic health. Responsiveness is the difference between an organization that is objectively learning and one that is just putting on a theatrical performance of debate.
So they actually have to change their behavior.
Yes. The community must actually change its beliefs, update its theories, and alter its trajectory when a valid point is made. They cannot just nod politely, say thank you for your feedback, and then file the critique in the trash.
Right.
The challenge must produce a tangible shift in what the community actually does.
It has to move the needle. The dominant paradigm has to bleed a little bit. And that leads to the fourth and final norm, which ensures that everyone actually has the leverage to force that needle to move.
Right. The fourth norm is the equality of intellectual authority.
Equality of authority.
It dictates that no voice can be excluded from the critical dialogue simply based on their social position, their lack of prestige, or their demographic background.
The focus is purely on the argument.
Yes. The merits of the contributions must be assessed strictly on epistemic grounds, the quality of the evidence, the rigor of the logic, not on who is holding the microphone.
Now, diving deep into this, the text emphasizes a point that completely changed how I read this paper. These four norms, avenues for criticism, share standards, responsiveness, and equality of authority, they sound exactly like modern corporate HR guidelines for being a polite, inclusive workplace.
They do sound like that, yeah.
But Longino and Dance are arguing something much more profound. These are not moral guidelines. They are strictly epistemic requirements.
That distinction is paramount. Longino is not arguing that you should follow these norms simply because it is the morally nice thing to do.
Right.
She is arguing that if a scientific community violates these four norms, the knowledge they produce is mathematically, structurally less objective.
Wow. Even if they're all geniuses.
It doesn't matter if the individuals in that community possess staggering, once-in-a-generation intellects. If they do not have avenues for criticism, flexible shared standards, genuine responsiveness, and equality of authority, their collective output will be structurally blind to reality.
Because they're turning off their sensors.
Exactly. Epistemic diversity isn't a quota. It is the sensor array the community uses to detect the truth. If you turn off half your sensors, you get bad data.
It requires a kind of constant, uncomfortable, exhausting maintenance.
Yeah.
You never just arrive at perfect objectivity and lock the door. You have to keep the gears turning, constantly absorbing friction.
Right. It's a continuous process.
Which naturally leads us into a fascinating application of this theory in the text. Let's explore scientific pluralism and what philosopher Nancy Cartwright calls the dappled world.
Okay, yes. To ground this in reality, the paper references Longino's book, Studying Human Behavior. In it, she examines how scientists attempt to research incredibly complex, multi-layered topics, specifically human aggression and human sexuality.
Two incredibly complex topics.
Very. And she points out that when you look at the field, there isn't just one monolithic scientific method being deployed. There are at least five different major research programs studying these exact same behaviors simultaneously.
And the paper notes that each of these five programs uses entirely different causal commitments, different tools, and different background assumptions.
Totally different blueprints.
Yeah. You have geneticists looking for DNA markers. You have neurobiologists scanning brain chemistry. You have developmental psychologists looking at childhood trauma. You have sociologists analyzing systemic poverty and environmental factors. And you have evolutionary biologists looking for ancient survival adaptations.
And the natural instinct for anyone observing this is to demand a winner. We want to ask, well, which one of them is right? Which one is the real cause of human aggression?
Because we want it to be simple.
Exactly. But Longino introduces the concept of scientific pluralism. She argues that none of the five approaches are simply wrong, but crucially, none of them are capable of capturing the full picture either. Each framework is designed to capture a specific dimension of the phenomena that the other frameworks are completely blind to.
I really love this concept because it perfectly maps onto how we navigate the physical world. Think about trying to understand a massive, complex system like New York City using maps.
Oh, that's a brilliant way to look at it.
Right. If you want to grasp the reality of the city, you could look at a subway map to understand the transit arteries. You could look at a topographical map to understand the elevation and flood zones. And you could look at a street-level traffic map.
And if you rely solely on the subway map, you'll have a very real, objective understanding of the underground network. But you will have absolutely no idea where the hills are.
Exactly. And the temptation is to say, let's just combine them all into one ultimate map. But if you took the subway map, the topographical map, and the street map, and printed them all perfectly layered on top of a single piece of paper, it would be a chaotic, unreadable mess.
It would be completely useless.
You literally cannot create one grand unified map that is actually useful for navigating daily life. You need the productive tension of keeping those multiple maps separate, referring to each one for the specific limited reality it perfectly describes.
That analogy perfectly illuminates what Nancy Cartwright means by the nomological machine, which is a concept Deitz integrates into the text.
A nomological machine.
Yes. A nomological machine is a bounded, carefully constructed system. It produces highly reliable objective facts, but it only produces them within its specific operating conditions.
So the map only works for its specific purpose.
Right. The geneticist's framework is a nomological machine calibrated to produce genetic facts. The sociologist's framework is a machine calibrated to produce social facts.
That makes total sense.
Scientific progress isn't always about smashing all these machines together in the hopes of creating one grand theory of everything. Sometimes mature scientific progress is simply maintaining that productive tension among multiple, partially valid frameworks.
That brings so much relief, honestly. It completely validates the intuition that reality is messy, complex, and requires multiple angles of approach. We don't have to force everything into one equation.
No, we don't.
But now we have to make the big transition in the paper. We've talked about philosophy, values, and social structures. Now we enter the core synthesis of C.F. Deitz's work, the closure framework.
This is a turning point.
Yeah. This is where Deitz takes Longino's philosophy of science and translates it into a universal structural logic.
Up until now, we've been examining the social dynamics of science. Deitz takes those social dynamics and maps them onto a deeper structural architecture called the closure framework.
Okay, so let's break this down.
To truly grasp this, we need to rigorously define two foundational concepts, the closure regime and the remainder.
Let's start with a closure regime. The text defines this as a system that stabilizes content by drawing distinctions and establishing identity criteria. That is a very dense academic sentence. How do we break that down?
Think of a closure regime as the cognitive and social boundary. A specific community draws around itself to make sense of a chaotic universe.
Like drawing a circle in the sand.
Yes. A scientific community is a shared social closure regime. Through their shared standards, their textbooks, and their methodologies, they draw distinctions. They decide what counts as a valid experiment and what is pseudoscience.
They establish the identity criteria of their field.
Exactly. The rules that define what they are even looking at.
So if we look at our earlier examples, the geneticists studying human aggression operate inside one closure regime. They have drawn a boundary that says, we look at DNA. We do not look at sociology. The closure is basically the protective bubble they operate inside. It is the world according to their specific rules and their specific tinted glasses. But the universe doesn't neatly fit inside our bubbles, does it?
It never does. And that friction, the reality that escapes the bubble, is what Deitz calls the remainder.
The remainder.
Yes. Deitz has this beautiful, almost haunting quote in the text. He writes, "Every finite closure generates remainder. The remainder is not noise. It is the proof that the grammar is finite."
The proof that the grammar is finite, that is heavy.
It really is.
It implies that our ways of speaking about and measuring the world will always fall short of reality itself. So the remainder is everything the current framework cannot explain.
Precisely. It is the anomalies that ruin the elegant graph. It is the questions that the current methodologies literally lack the vocabulary to even address. It is the lived experiences and perspectives that the dominant group is entirely blind to.
So it's all the stuff left outside the circle.
Yes. Every single time a community draws a line in the sand and says, this is how we define reality, they inevitably leave some portion of reality on the outside of that line. That left out reality is the remainder. It is constantly bouncing off the outside of the closure's bubble.
So if we synthesize these two massive ideas, mapping Longino's philosophy onto Dietz's structure, Longino's background assumptions are exactly what Dietz calls the identity criteria that define the closure regime.
That's right.
And the marginalized critiques, like the feminist biologist pointing out the ignored female primates, that is the remainder pressing against the glass.
That is a perfect synthesis. And it leads to the mechanical question of progress.
Okay.
If the closure is the bubble, and the remainder is the friction of unacknowledged reality pressing against the outside of that bubble, how does the bubble grow? Because science obviously advances. We don't just stay stuck in the medical paradigms of the 16th century forever.
Right. The bubble has to expand to include new truths.
Dietz explains that this expansion happens through a structural process called supersession.
Supersession.
When the remainder, the unexplained anomalies, the marginalized perspectives, the failed experiments, when it accumulates to a critical mass, it starts pressing intensely against the boundaries of the closure.
Okay.
If the community is functioning properly, if it is epistemically healthy, it uses Longino's four norms as the mechanical engine to process that remainder.
So they use their avenues for criticism, their shared standards, and their equality of authority to engage in transformative criticism.
Yes. They take the anomaly seriously. They allow the critique to challenge their background assumptions. And when they finally update their identity criteria to make sense of the anomaly, the closure expands.
The framework shifts to account for the new reality.
Yes. That structural update, that absorption of the unknown into the known, is supersession.
So Longino's concept of transformative criticism is the exact same mechanism as Dietz's community-level supersession.
They are mapping the same thing.
The four norms are literally the digestive tract that allows a community to consume its own remainder, extract the nutrients, and grow larger. That is a stunning, elegant synthesis of philosophy and structural logic.
It really is. It takes these lofty philosophical best practices for scientific debate and reveals them to be the fundamental physics of how any organized group of humans learns anything about the universe.
Which brings us to the dark, inevitable inverse of this equation. We've seen how it works when the engine is running smoothly. But we need to explore what happens when it breaks down.
Right, when the system fails.
What happens when a community does not possess those four norms? What if they shut down the avenues for criticism or blatantly refuse to respond to it?
When those norms are absent or actively suppressed, the closure regime becomes what Dietz categorizes as rigid.
A rigid closure.
Now, a rigid closure continues to generate remainder because reality will always produce anomalies that defy human categories. But a rigid community lacks the organizational capacity or the will to use that remainder to grow.
So it just ignores it.
Basically, it stops being a living, breathing ecosystem and becomes a fortified bunker.
The paper details the clinical symptoms of a rigid closure. And frankly, reading this section felt like diagnosing a terrifying number of modern institutions.
Oh, absolutely. It's very relatable.
In a rigid closure, established investigators who hold the dominant background assumptions simply ignore criticism from those with different values. They are so insulated by their shared standards that they don't even perceive the critique as valid noise, let alone a signal.
Or, even more insidiously, they engage in a tactic the text explicitly calls performative deliberation rather than substantive supersession.
Performative deliberation. I want to pause the theory for a second and talk directly to you, the listener, because this is where the paper bleeds out of the laboratory and into your daily life. Think about your own workplace, your corporate board, or even like a local city council meeting. Have you ever been in a room where a massive, glaring problem is brought up? A huge piece of remainder that everyone knows is failing. And the leadership responds by saying, "We hear you. Your feelings are valid. We're going to form an exploratory committee to look into this and draft a memo."
Right. The classic corporate response.
Exactly. But then months go by, the memo is filed away, and absolutely nothing structural changes.
That scenario is the textbook definition of performative deliberation. The institution recognizes that it needs to look like it has avenues for criticism.
So it sets up the microphone, but unplugs it.
Perfectly said. The challenge is officially acknowledged. It's logged in the minutes, so it appears that the system is open. But there is zero genuine epistemic uptake.
The constituted facts of the organization, the actual identity criteria driving their actions, do not shift a single inch.
Not at all. The remainder is merely managed, pacified, and ultimately ignored rather than absorbed.
It is the organizational equivalent of going through the motions of a debate purely to preserve the illusion of objectivity, while the closure itself remains completely, stubbornly rigid. The bubble refuses to grow.
And that dynamic encapsulates the overarching thesis of this entire deep dive perfectly.
Yeah, it really does.
The fundamental question we should be asking about science or any truth-seeking endeavor isn't whether human values shape our knowledge. They absolutely do. Every single closure regime is built out of the contextual values of its architects.
So what is the real question?
The real pressing question is whether a community's organizational structure allows those values to be challenged, bruised, and revised when the external world inevitably presses back through the remainder.
That is such an empowering, clarifying way to look at the world. It completely reframes how we should interact with the avalanche of information we face every day.
It truly does. It takes the highly abstract academic concepts of epistemology and the philosophy of science and forges them into a highly practical tool for evaluating the institutions we rely on to tell us what is real.
Which brings us toward the end of an incredibly epic journey today. We started by dismantling that pervasive myth of the lone genius in the sterile white lab.
We did.
We proved that contextual values, our personal biases, our cultural backgrounds, our funding pressures, they aren't just flaws to be scrubbed away. They are the necessary blueprints for making sense of raw evidence.
Then we walked through Longino's four non-negotiable norms: recognized avenues for criticism, shared evaluative standards, genuine responsiveness, and the equality of intellectual authority.
And we established that those aren't just polite suggestions for a utopian society. They are the required structural mechanisms for generating objectivity.
And finally, we saw how C.F. Deitz's closure framework maps this all out into a universal logic. We all exist inside closures, drawing distinctions to survive. We constantly generate remainder, the anomalies that don't fit our maps.
And if our communities are healthy, diverse, and follow those four norms, we achieve supersession. We absorb the unknown. We grow.
So why should you, as the listener, care deeply about all of this? Because internalizing this dynamic gives you a literal superpower for evaluating the information landscape.
Yes. When you read a new scientific study on your feed, or hear a politician make a grand claim, or read a corporate press release about a new initiative, you shouldn't waste your energy asking, is this person perfectly unbiased?
Because the answer, scientifically and philosophically, is always no.
Exactly. Instead, you should ask the far more revealing structural question. Is this person part of a community that actively tries to prove itself wrong?
Are they part of a closure regime that processes its remainder through diverse, sense-formative criticism? Or are they hiding inside a rigid bubble, engaging in performative deliberation?
That is the ultimate litmus test for truth in the modern world. Now, before we sign off, I know you have one final, incredibly provocative thought you wanted to share.
Oh, yes, I do.
It's something that builds purely on Deitz's framework, but scales it up to a level that honestly gave me vertigo when we discussed it earlier.
It is definitely a concept to mull over long after this deep dive ends. Deitz briefly notes in the text that this closure framework applies recursively.
What does that mean, recursively?
It means it scales. It applies to individual minds, it applies to small scientific communities, but it also applies to the entire lineage of human inquiry.
The entire lineage.
Think about the implications of that phrase. Human inquiry as a whole, every science, every philosophy, every civilization, is just one massive shared closure regime.
Wait, the entire human species is inside one bubble.
Yes. We are a single closure regime driven by our shared biology, our terrestrial values, our specific sensory organs, and the specific way our neural networks evolved on this specific planet.
Oh, wow.
We possess collective identity criteria simply by virtue of being human beings, which raises a staggering, almost terrifying question.
Okay, ready.
If humanity is one giant closure regime, what does our collective human remainder look like?
Oh my God.
What are the anomalies pressing against the extreme outer boundaries of human comprehension? What is the friction of reality that we literally lack the biological and cognitive grammar to even register as criticism?
That is wow.
We might be entirely surrounded by a vast universe of remainder, phenomena, dimensions, truths that our species' collective blueprints simply cannot perceive, let alone absorb through supersession.
That is deeply, wonderfully unsettling.
Yeah.
It means that the pristine, sterile white laboratory we imagined at the very beginning of this deep dive isn't just a myth about individual scientists.
No, it's bigger than that.
The laboratory itself, the entire human endeavor of trying to lock reality into a room we can measure and understand, is just a tiny, fragile bubble floating in an infinite ocean of remainder.
Beautifully said.
And the only possible way that bubble expands, the only way we don't become a rigid, dead species, is if we force ourselves to keep the heavy steel doors wide open to the unknown. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning your closures, keep looking for the remainder, and we will catch you next time.